This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. I hope you found out about us by now. We've been doing this for several years. What we do on this program is talk about, in the widest possible way, what's now referred to as behavioral health. That covers a lot of ground. Mental health issues for sure, a particular emphasis very often on substance abuse, and because those two things very often go hand in hand, we cover that as well. Recovery Radio is sponsored by Retreat Behavioral Health, about which more later. As we round out September, which is set aside every year internationally, I believe, to focus on recovery from substance abuse, we're going to handle a couple of issues regarding that very important topic with our guest on the telephone from Penn State Berks campus, Penn State University. We are really pleased to have Dr. Jennifer Murphy with us this morning, this program. Dr. Murphy is an associate professor of criminal justice, and she is program coordinator for criminal justice as well. Among the many research interests she is pursuing, there is the shift long overdue from criminalization to medicalization with regard to drug addiction. She takes a deep look at drug courts and whether or not they're helpful and how they work, and a couple of other very important issues, which obviously we need to talk about with regard to the issue of substance abuse. So we want to welcome Jennifer Murphy with us to the program. Doctor or professor, which do you prefer?
Oh, whichever you prefer. Either one is fine.
Okay. I've gotten caught on the wrong side of that too many times not to ask ahead of time. Dr. Murphy, thanks so much for joining us on Recovery Radio. Did I get most of that right about what you do and your fields of expertise?
Yes. Thank you for having me, and I'm happy to be here.
I want to start with the one thing I said at the beginning here that I think is finally occurred and much overdue, and that is this obvious shift away from a war on drugs in the criminal justice context to a more public health issue and the medicalization of the situation of substance abuse. How far into that shift are we as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think I share some of your optimism about that shift, but maybe I don't think we're quite to where we need to be yet. So I think you sound a little bit more optimistic about where we are currently than I would say we are in that trajectory. Sure, absolutely. We have shifted in a lot of ways from a more criminal justice approach to dealing with drug-related offenses, but I don't think we're quite at the level to say that we have adopted a completely public health approach to handling drug addiction. We're somewhere in the middle, and we have moved more toward that public health side of things, but in a lot of ways, our policy is still resisting a full medicalization of drug addiction issues. We certainly have seen a shift in the designation of certain offenses and the punishment associated with those. So small amounts in possession, especially concerning marijuana, have been decriminalized in many places, outright legalized in some states and jurisdictions like Washington, D.C. But we still take a more punitive approach when we talk about other substances, and in the context of our current opioid crisis, in some ways we start talking about increasing criminal penalties for certain things like drug dealing and offenses where someone could actually be held accountable for the death of someone whom they gave drugs to. Mm. So in that context, we actually talk about ratcheting up offenses in some way. So we're not quite on this clear trajectory toward complete medicalization. We're somewhere in the middle, and we you know, it's a little bit bumpier than just kind of a straight line toward medicalization.
Yeah, I suppose you're the first person, by the way, in a long time who's accused me of being an optimist about anything. But I will say this. I mean, I'm old enough, and looking at your picture, older than you, to remember a time not so very long ago when all of this was the same thing. It was illegal. It was antisocial. It was a danger to society. And we were going to lock these people up. We even used war footing metaphors. This would be
right.
A war on drugs. So when I look at it in a positive sense, it's that we've moved away from that to a more realistic view. I suppose what you're saying, and I understand this completely, is that we're in the middle because these drugs, many of these drugs, are still just plainly illegal. So absent a complete legalization of every substance, in other words, the complete, I guess, libertarian view that people can put anything they want into their bodies, we're never going to get to a completely, no criminal aspect to this, right?
Right, but we could still adopt other public health approaches that we have been more controversial here than they have in many other places. Things like needle exchange programs. The state of Pennsylvania still has a statewide ban on needle exchange. Mm-hmm. Needle exchange, has been shown it's not in dispute what the health benefits are concerning needle exchange as far as reducing the transmission of infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis, not increasing drug use, actually being a possible resource for people to access drug treatment services. But yet we still have a resistance to those kinds of programs. So I agree with you that it would take this really large philosophical shift in our approach to how we think about drugs and people using drugs to become completely medicalized. But at the same time, there still are other steps we could take within our current framework that other places have taken and shown to be successful.
So I'm guessing, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the reluctance to implement some of the items you just mentioned is because of the confusion over what they're actually intended to do. You describe them in the context of harm reduction. And people who resist things like needle exchange or safe injection sites still seem to view that as enabling or facilitating the use of drugs. Yes. Is that the problem?
Yes. The problem is we still have a very moralistic view of drug use. We talk about it as a disease. If you survey the American public, the majority will say that they agree with the idea that drug addiction is a disease. But there are still these moral elements, and people will cite these moral factors that play into using drugs. So any moral view of drug use and the view that drug use is bad, drug use is wrong, people should not use drugs, people who use drugs lack moral values. You know, these are statements that people will subscribe to at the same time they're saying addiction is a disease. Mm-hmm. So, this confusion over, okay, if it's a disease, but it still retains these moralistic elements, then yes, when you talk about these other policies and you try to talk about the research and just how pragmatic they are for dealing with health issues, those moral arguments creep in that somehow they enable drug use. Somehow we're condoning drug use if we adopt these approaches.
Well, the thing about the opioid epidemic that I've always been struck by is that it's so widespread. It metastasized out of its, I guess, historic locations, which were in the underclass and inner city communities, people of color, to the suburban larger population, people in a different economic class as well. That certainly facilitated this move towards medicalization. But it also struck me that if this were a problem, addiction, were a problem that were airborne, that you could catch it, then I think you would see a full mobilization of everything that the society and the government has. We still don't view it that way. And very often it does feel like this disease can be caught in a kind of I don't know, metaphorical sense. Am I reaching too far here?
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. But I think we do stigmatize other, you know, diseases that we might see as more biological in nature. You know, if you look at funding for different types of cancer, there's the lowest amount of funding goes to lung cancer because there's still this moral judgment. If you get lung cancer, you're somehow partly at fault, you know, especially if it was due to some kind of smoking related behavior. You know, look at the history of HIV and the stigma and, mm-hmm. you know, the issues with funding around that early on. Mm-hmm. So we do, anytime we're associating, you know, what we see as someone being at fault for contracting even what we see as a legitimate disease or illness, you know, that those moral judgments are going to come into things like funding.
Sure. Well, is there any data of the effect of that way of thinking in other places? By that I mean in other places faced with substance abuse issues where the moral component is not as strong, are they more effective in dealing with this?
I would say so. I took students to the Netherlands last spring break as part of a comparative drug policy course I was teaching in the spring semester, and we studied their approach to handling drug-related issues. The Netherlands had a very serious opioid problem in the 1980s and 1990s. A huge proportion of their population was using heroin. And as a result, there was an increase in crime. There was an increase in other kinds of, you know, issues in as far as discarded needles on the streets, homelessness, people feeling like it was unsafe to walk through their neighborhoods. And they took a different approach than we did. You know, at that time, we're dealing with our own, you know, crack cocaine, quote unquote, epidemic. And we, like you talked about with the war on drugs, basically tried to arrest our way out of that. They took a different approach. They took a more public health approach. They instituted large-scale needle exchange programs. Needle exchange even operated out of police stations. They tried to get people into treatment, into other kinds of services that they might need to deal with other problems like employment, homelessness, mental health, physical health. So they had a very integrated approach to trying to help people. And if you go there today, they don't have these problems anymore. Mm-hmm. And we visited a clinic that administers medical heroin. So this is a hospital setting where people who have a long-term addiction to heroin can receive daily, you know, funded by the government, doses of heroin, basically as a way to sustain them so that they are not using on the street, and because other treatment modalities just were not successful for them.
Professor, let me stop you right there because we're running out of time in the segment. I do want to pick up on this because it goes to the heart of something that you've written about called Understanding One's Addiction and how that shapes your opinions about it. You just painted a pretty good description of someplace where they've changed their opinions. Professor, Jennifer Murphy is our guest from Penn State, talking about substance abuse and a wider range of criminal justice issues which surround that problem. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Our guest on the telephone is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice and Program Coordinator for Criminal Justice at Penn State University's Berks campus. Dr. Jennifer Murphy's been with us, and this is a terrific topic and something that we've wanted to get, you know, sort of deep into the weeds about for a while with regard to how people view the problem of substance abuse and how that can shape policy. Let's get a little deeper into that. I know you've written very specifically about the title of the book was Understanding One's Addiction. Am I right about that?
The title of the book is Illness or Deviance.
Oh, okay. Talk about what happens when we shift our opinions and context about this and how that can lead to more enlightened and effective policies.
Sure, absolutely. The way we conceptualize addiction, how we think about it, whether we think about it in more medical terms or whether we think about it in more moralistic terms, then informs our policy and how we think we should deal with drug use in general, the criminalization of drugs, and what to do when people are arrested for drug-related offenses. So when we hold more medicalized views of addiction and not so much that it's the person's fault or that they are lacking some moral value or they lack willpower, when we see it in more medicalized terms, we tend to view the response to be also more medicalized. So if someone is arrested for something drug-related, like drug possession, for instance, then we think, well, they should be offered drug treatment in lieu of incarceration. And we are more in favor of those kinds of programs that integrate drug treatment right into the criminal justice system.
For people listening who are sympathetic to the size of the problem and know we need to do something about it, but recognize this tension or conflict between society's moral position and their need to solve a problem, what do you experts tell them? Is it one or the other?
Well, I think different people have different moral beliefs about this. I mean, you can have a moral belief that we need to help people and we need to, give people medical and mental health care that they require, and that itself is a moral response. And you can also have a moral view where people who use drugs are just bad and they are not deserving of our sympathy and our resources. So I think the moral nature of addiction can go either way. I think the pragmatic part is something that whatever your moral belief is just something that, you know, we need to focus more on. That, you know, having pragmatic policies that are the most cost-effective, help the most amount of, help people, you know, increase quality of life for everyone, you know, entire communities. Those are the policies that we should be adopting, regardless of how we moralize drug use.
And unfortunately, in the past, what seems to have been the preferred method was to, in a benign way, say and do things like just say no, or even the DARE program, which was the program where they sent experts into the very young classrooms of young people and I guess tried to tell them the dangers of this drug. Just say no clearly
right.
Doesn't work, and I guess DARE didn't either.
No, the research showed that DARE had basically no effect on future drug use for people who were part of that program. And the thing about DARE was it was often a police officer who went into schools, and the main message was to try to scare young people into not using drugs, and, you know, it was part of that just say no message as well. And I think part of the problem is we've also distorted a lot of facts around drugs and the effects of substances, and we exaggerate certain claims about these things, and then we develop policy based on those inaccuracies.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the laws created in the 1980s to penalize crack cocaine at a higher level than powder cocaine, right? The famous 100-to-1 disparity, where you would automatically get a mandatory minimum sentence for possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine, but you needed 500 grams of powder cocaine to trigger that same mandatory minimum.
Yep.
And that was based on this notion that crack cocaine is a fundamentally different substance, produces different effects than powder cocaine. It causes people to be violent. It's the reason why we see a spike in violent crime in urban areas. You know, it's people using crack cocaine, causing all this violence. And these were the messages that were used to enact that policy. And then, you know, research ends up showing that, well, actually, pharmacologically, these substances are not actually different.
Yeah, by the way, I remember when that study was suppressed, more or less, by one administration in Washington because it didn't hold up to their current model. Real quickly, marijuana is a case in point. The earliest attitudes about this, going back to the early part of the last century, was that it caused everything from insanity to just mayhem, and it was just the devil's weed. And the pendulum, which was way to one side at that point, has now swung utterly to the other side. It's now a cure for everything and should be legalized or at least decriminalized. And I think there's some danger in that as well.
Yeah, and one of the things that you really hit upon in looking at the war on drugs in the 1970s and 1980s, 1990s, and then this war against the early war against marijuana in the 1930s was there was a lot of racist propaganda as part of those arguments. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, you know, it wasn't college kids we were afraid of using marijuana in the 1930s that led to the Marijuana Tax Act being passed. It was jazz musicians. Hmm. It was Mexican immigrants. Mm-hmm. And the same with the 1980s. You know, that crack and powder cocaine disparity was largely a result of the demographics of who was using each of those substances. And the increased penalties had an immense effect on the arrest and incarceration rates of people of color,
which have now exploded. Jennifer Murphy is our guest. Dr. Murphy is associate producer of criminal justice at Penn State Berks campus. We have more with her straight ahead. This is Recovery Radio. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you. We'll return to our guest, Dr. Jennifer Murphy, straight ahead. But first, I want to remind you that we offer the program we have all these years as an informational and educational tool. We hope we provide information that answers questions for you about something, substance abuse in this case, for which no one really plans. No one plans on having this disease visit them. And when it does, people are forced to make extraordinary decisions under extraordinary circumstances. So where do you turn? Retreat Behavioral Health sponsors this program, but we're not here to tell you they're the only place that can help you with these problems. They're one of the best, that's for sure. I give you their phone number and tell you every week, this is for questions you have about anything here in the program or any questions about substance abuse or in general behavioral health. They will answer them for you. 855-859-8808. That's how you reach them at Retreat Behavioral Health. 855-859-8808. From Penn State's Burke campus, we have been speaking with Professor Jennifer Murphy in her expertise here in this area. This has really been great stuff, Dr. Murphy. Let's talk about something else I know you have taken a long, hard look at, and that is drug courts. Tell us about drug courts, how they work, who qualifies for them, and whether they do any good at all.
Sure. Drug courts emerged in the late 1980s as a response to how backed up our court system got with drug-related cases. They started in – the first one opened in 1989 in Miami, Florida, and they quickly spread throughout the nation. And if you were to look today, I believe the number is over 3,000 exist currently in the United States. They've also been adopted internationally. So many countries looked at this model that we developed and use it in their own country as well. Drug court is a program, and there's going to be some differences, you know, across areas and in where they're implemented and who they're targeting, but they have a set of key components that all of them are supposed to adhere to. So one of them is integrating drug treatment services as part of the processing of this case. So someone who's arrested for an offense and is seen as eligible for drug court, they would then become a part of this program where they are evaluated for their treatment need. They are then enrolled in outpatient, most of the time it's outpatient drug treatment services, and they also meet with a drug court judge once a month. So they appear in front of the drug court judge once a month who monitors their progress. The programs vary in length, but typically are designed to last about a year. Most people going through the programs end up in the program a little bit longer, because if there's any kind of sanction, then they have to go back to the beginning of that phase of the program and you know, repeat some things. So most people end up going through the program taking longer than the 12 months that I guess is designed for. And they, at the end of it, if they're successful, most of the time their case is expunged. So a lot of these charges are felony drug charges. So that's a huge incentive for someone to enter the drug court program, because if they successfully complete it, they won't have that record afterward. The other part of that, it's a carrot and stick model, which is the drug courts are very upfront about that. The carrot is that expungement. The stick is you basically forego any other legal rights to a trial or any other kind of due process, basically, with this offense, and you just are automatically sentenced to prison if you fail. So that's the stick.
Well, so as I understand that, this idea of drug court, this diversionary program, began for real world reasons that have nothing to do with attitudes about substance abuse or whether it's a disease or not, but to relieve a backlog in the court system. And it has now morphed into something broader than that. So let me ask you, who qualifies for this? I mean, if I've been arrested and accused of selling enormous quantities of some drug, I don't know. Do I have access to drug court, or do you have to be addicted to these drugs?
Yeah, so it depends. Most courts are going to exclude anything that's a violent offense. So if you are dealing large amounts of drugs, but you're also caught with a gun when you're arrested, that would be that gun charge would make you ineligible for drug court. So violent offenses are excluded. And it's interesting because in the context of what we've seen recently with a lot of decriminalization of drug possession or, you know, just kind of lesser offenses in general, drug court had to widen its net a little bit for people who are eligible based on their offense. So one drug court in particular that I studied, they only targeted people who sold drugs, because people who got arrested for drug possession basically would just get probation. So the drug court was not an attractive alternative to them, because it's much more demanding as far as the requirements and the time that you put into it. So most of them would just prefer to plead guilty basically and take probation as a sanction than go through drug court. So they had to widen that net a little bit. So they focused on felony drug selling charges, but again, nonviolent.
Yes.
Someone who's also picked up for, you know, an offense, again, a nonviolent offense, but maybe doesn't have anything to do specifically with drugs, but they say they have a drug problem and they're evaluated as needing drug treatment services, then they could become eligible for drug court as well. So there is the necessary component that the person has to need drug treatment. But that can be widened as well. The National Drug Court Association would say that, you know, they're very specific in their targeting and someone absolutely needs substance abuse treatment as part of the program. But when I was looking into it, there were a whole lot of people who probably wouldn't actually meet clinical criteria for having a substance use disorder who were still eligible for drug court. So it does throw a little bit of a little bit of a wrench into the work.
Yeah. Who's responsible, or how does one who's swept up in the criminal justice system because of drugs find out what they qualify for? Is it their attorney or the public defender who tells them, look, you can be diverted through this, or does the court have to tell them that? How does that work?
It would depend on where they are. I think if they had an attorney who was knowledgeable about drug court, they could give them that information. If they're in an area like Philadelphia, it's going to be presented to them mainly through the district attorney's office based on their charge. Most drug courts, at least, and this was several years ago that I was studying some of these drug courts that I'm talking about, they were at capacity. So they kind of had a target of who they were trying to get into those drug courts. Like I said, for the one, it was felony drug selling charges. So the district attorney's office basically would flag the cases that were eligible for drug court. But if you're in a rural area where, it's maybe they're not completely full, as far as their slots, you might have to access it through your own attorney or just knowing about it and inquiring about it.
Mm-hmm. With regard to mandating treatment through something like drug court, do they do that? And is mandatory treatment effective?
So treatment is a necessary component of the drug court program. So you have to go to some kind of drug treatment program as part of it. So you are deemed to be clinically in need of drug treatment, and then you have to successfully complete that, whatever drug treatment program you're determined to go to, you need to complete that program to be successful in the drug court. So it is a mandatory component of the program. It's coerced treatment is controversial because those who support it would say that it's just as effective as voluntary treatment. Those who would be on the other side would say that the data are a little bit more mixed. And when you're talking about something like a drug court program where a good proportion of people might actually not have a serious drug use problem but are still seen as appropriate for drug treatment, it's then not much of a surprise that they would be successful at completing drug treatment. When I was doing my research, I even talked to counselors in drug treatment programs that dealt with drug court clients, and a lot of them admitted that a lot of their drug court clients don't actually have serious substance use problems. They were arrested for selling drugs. They might periodically smoke marijuana, but that, using drugs is not actually a serious problem for them. So for them to then successfully complete treatment, well, it's not that hard of a thing for them to do.
Yeah. And with regard to someone who can't afford, private treatment, does the court provide beds and treatment in situations like that?
Yes. So the funding for the drug court is going to include the funding for treatment. There are some, court fees that the person that's going through the drug court program would be responsible for, but they're not responsible for paying for their own drug treatment. If they have some kind of insurance that would cover it, then they would use that. But they would not be seen as ineligible for the program if they couldn't afford to pay for treatment.
We're talking to Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at Penn State, Dr. Jennifer Murphy. We have more with Dr. Murphy straight ahead. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We've had a terrific conversation with our guest from Penn State, the Berks campus, Penn State University, Dr. Jennifer Murphy, Professor of Criminal Justice and Program Coordinator for Criminal Justice. She's been giving us a real broad overview of the disease of addiction and how it intersects with not only the courts and laws and the police, but also how it continues to impact society and society's perception about this situation. So Dr. Murphy, let's circle back to this notion of the difference between an illness that someone's suffering from and some bad behavior or deviant behavior. Where would you say we are in that situation?
I think we're somewhere in the middle of the criminalization and medicalization continuum, like we were talking about earlier. I think there are a lot of signs to show positive development there as far as the medicalization of addiction, the increasing acceptance of pharmacological treatments, for instance, is one sign of that. In general, we were more reluctant to see pharmacological treatments for things like opioid addiction as legitimate. There was a lot of discussion both within the recovery community and then also in the medical community about how that's just substituting one drug for another. And we do have a shift in conversation about that. I wouldn't say we are completely to accepting that medicalized treatment in all communities, but we definitely have made progress there. Even going back to drug courts, there were many drug courts up until very recently that would not allow drug court participants to receive methadone, buprenorphine as part of treatment. They would be seen as ineligible for drug court if they were going to do those kinds of medicalized treatments. And now drug courts all have accepted medicalized treatment, those pharmacological treatments, as legitimate.
Yeah.
But that's a very recent development.
It is, yeah. The marijuana situation is a graphic example of the schizophrenia that still exists with regard to our attitude towards drugs in general. You have the states racing to legalize this stuff while the federal government says it's still illegal.
Right.
And we don't
quite know how that's going to play out yet, because as administrations change, the perspective of what states can do changes, right? You had the Obama administration issue the Cole memo that basically said, well, we're not going to go after states who enact their own marijuana legalization. It's not going to be a priority for the Justice Department. But one of the first things that happened in the Trump administration was, when Jeff Sessions was Attorney General, he rescinded that memo. Mm-hmm. So it left things a little bit up in the air. Well, what is the federal government going to do? They absolutely have the legal right to go in there and stop it. They haven't yet, but it's not to say that it wouldn't happen.
Well, what's important about not only the subject in general, but certainly your work is we keep circling back to this, and one more time, you're right, administrations come and go, policies change as a result. The work that needs to be done, I'm guessing, is that the public at large has to be better educated about the whole situation so that their opinions can change. And if opinions change, then policy has to follow. Is that pretty much the case?
Yeah, and I think you see that. The public is very dissatisfied with the way the war on drugs went and see it largely as a failure. So now moving forward, we have to, be logical and pragmatic about, well, what are the policies going to be then moving forward? And there absolutely needs to be a lot of education about addiction, about what addiction is. This notion that people accept the idea of it as a disease, I don't think they fully realize what that means and what the disease actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And we need much more education for people to be able to really understand what it is and then to make better policy about how to deal with it.
Yes, and maybe we'll move past this lingering notion, which is still widely held, and that is, why don't they just stop? Why don't they just stop this behavior? Well, anyway, a big topic, and we've covered some of it, but we could talk much more about this. We want to thank Dr. Jennifer Murphy from Penn State for joining us on the program and shedding a lot more light on this. Dr. Murphy, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. All of you, enjoy the rest of whatever this day holds for you, and look for Recovery Radio, as I always say, wherever finer podcasts can be heard. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.